Life.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
Protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
Movement.
It's my mistake, and let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum,
identity,
family,
home,
conscience,
expression,
expression.
Expression, expression,
participation,
democracy,
welfare,
work,
work,
leisure,
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 health,
education,
focus,
culture,
human rights,
Charter Dana,
solidarity,
responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good afternoon to all our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM and over the internet at cjtr.ca. We can also be heard on SaskTel Max at channel 806 and Access Communications Digital Service at channel 700. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a collection of musicians from around the world. My name is Jim Hutchings. I'm joined by my co-host Gordon Barnes with special guests Gary Geddes and Bruce Rice. I think most of us around Regina are familiar with Bruce. He's kind of a fixture as a writer, poet, and we've seen him at poetry slams and things like that. And Gary, I think you're originally from the prairies.
I was born in Vancouver, but I spent four really important years in Saskatchewan when I was a kid.
Right.
Outside Yorkton.
And you've been doing an awful lot of stuff and very, very well known as a writer and an educator. And I'm just wondering, what brings you to this part of the world?
Well, I'm always trying to get back to Saskatchewan because I love the art scene here, and I know so many people, and there's something magical about this place. And so this time my wife and I have a book out at the same time, so we decided rather than, you know, ships in the night promoting across the country, why don't we do it together? She's a novelist, Anne Erickson. And so that's what we're up to. And we've set up a reading tour across Canada. We're doing 27 gigs all the way to Newfoundland and back, driving. And Regina is the first, well, not the first stop, the third stop.
Right, right.
I have to say that writers in Saskatchewan just couldn't resist the opportunity of hearing a little bit more from Gary. So we're having some meetings with him, and he's got a long background in editing and contacts and writing and involvement in writing community in Canada. So we're making sure he has a good time here, and we're going to try to exhaust him if we can.
I'm just
exploit. That's the word.
Yes.
I'm just looking at your CV here from Wikipedia, and it claims that you've written and edited over 35 books, including 17 books of poetry, as well as fiction, nonfiction, drama, translation, criticism, and anthologies. Your work's been translated into 5 languages. And before embarking on your literary career, you've worked as a gill net fisherman, loaded boxcars at BC Sugar Refinery, stocked shelves at Woodward's, worked as a fishing guide, and drove a water taxi. Pretty
it's
broad.
It's a little bit out of date. It's up to 45 now.
Okay.
Wow.
Yeah.
Scribble, scribble.
Fantastic. So what is the most the book that you're promoting at the moment?
Here? I'm promoting a selected poems called What Does a House Want? It's a collection drawn from a whole lifetime of writing poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite a challenge to look at the stuff and decide which was expendable, which was juvenilia, and what was worth keeping.
So you probably had a sort of a goal, or like you got to have sort of X number of, we don't have room for any more than a certain number of poems, or
I had a selected out, Jim, earlier in my career, and a British publisher also wanted to do a version, so we had a co-publication in Canada and the UK, but the British publisher could only handle 98 pages, so it was fairly slim pickings. And I would go off on reading tours, and I'd be wanted to promote this book, and I didn't have all the poems that I wanted to read. This time, it's been easier. The U.S. publisher, Red Hen Press, has given me 240 pages.
Wow.
The book is beautifully spaced, lots of air and blank, you know, white space.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a chance to put a lot of pieces from some of my long poems in there.
So this is mostly a work of like an anthology of poems?
It's like, I suppose in the old days they used to call these anthologies.
Okay.
They now call them selected poems.
I'm kind of old.
Well, me too.
And Gary, I had to laugh at the blurb on the back of your book by Billy Collins, who's a former Library of Congress poet laureate. Thought of as quite an accessible poet, but he says something like, at last, it says, a work by a poet appears to be at least interested in the world as he is in himself.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting that you bring that up, Bruce, because when I was young, I started writing these very intense little confessional poems, and they were ghastly little poems. They were self-indulgent, and one of my office mates, Gus Heidemann, said to me, Gary, William Blake found a universe in a grain of sand, but you're not going to find one in your belly button. So stop contemplating it. So I crept out of the office and I went home to my little flat and had a bottle of beer, turned on the television, and there was a film about Charles Whitman, the sniper at the University of Texas, who shot a lot of people.
Right, right.
And I was really troubled by that whole incident, and the Whitman family producing one of the greatest poets in the U.S. in the 19th century and a mass murder in the 20th century.
It's the same family?
same name.
Okay, all right.
I thought, well, maybe this is what Gus Heidemann meant when he told me to start looking around me in the world. So I wrote a poem about that, and that was the first really serious poem I think I ever wrote.
Does this kind of get to be a habit for you? I mean, like, you, when something strikes you in your experience, you kind of go looking for a piece of paper and a pen?
It's true. The things that trouble me morally or ethically are the ones that most often drive me to write. There are some moments of pain and anguish in family and friends, but mostly I think my attention is slightly broader, things in the city, in the province, in the country, and all around the globe. I've written poems about the Spanish conquest of the Americas, the first emperor of China, and the coup in Chile and the Middle East and so on. So I covered a lot of ground. I remember Peter Zosky interviewed me once on CBC, and he said, Gary, why do you travel so much? I think he was looking for a straight answer, mm-hmm, a serious mm-hmm. answer. I said, Peter, I travel for the same reason that a bagpiper walks back and forth when he plays. And there was this silence, and he said, okay, what is it? And I said, a moving target is harder to hit.
Yeah, there's, you know, it's interesting, though. You have some poems that are written in response to immediate events. And I know, for example, after 9/11, there were some poets in the U.S. who said, we won't be able to write about this for years. And yet on the flip side, you've written about some things in response to very immediate events, almost as, and not only individual events, dramatic events like that, but actually as you're traveling and immediately experiencing, and some of them come out fairly soon afterwards. So it really begs the question of whether something written in the moment like that is sustainable over time. I mean, people are still reading these poems about the tower and other poems.
Yeah. Well, mostly it takes me a long time to write anything half decent. The poem that I'm most known for, I think, is called Sandra Lee Scheuer. It's about the killings at Kent State mm-hmm. University. And that grew out of my left leanings and protests in front of the U.S. consulate in Toronto when I was a graduate student. I looked a bit like Tarek Ali at that point, with a long beard and dark hair. And I was really concerned about the issues like the Vietnam War and segregation and so on. So I was there protesting, and somebody said to me, do you know what happened at Kent State today? And it was a shock. It was like a Grand Canyon had opened up between a generation gap between myself and my parents. And I felt this incredible responsibility to respond to this in some way. And so I sat down, and for 6 years I maddeningly tried to write about it. And all I could work with was anger. Anger at the system which had mm-hmm. done this to people, the killing of 4 students and wounding of 9 others. It was bad American diatribes, and there were plenty of those already without, you know, a squeaky Canadian voice coming up with another one. Then I was in Edmonton as writer in residence, and I went out to the Wee Book Inn one day on White Avenue. And I picked a small red paperback from the shelf called The Killings at Kent State by that great American journalist, I.F. Stone. And it had some details about the victims, one of the victims, the description that Stone made was so powerful that I just felt this light going on, or saw this light going on, and knew that that was where the poem would begin. It was about Sandra Lee, one of the women killed.
Mm-hmm.
And he described 4 details that touched me. She said she was a speech therapy student. She was very tidy. She liked to roller skate. And she was not the least bit political.
Wow.
Maybe I can read that one.
Absolutely.
For you. Just for... We're missing a line or two from that sheet, so let me just get it out of my book.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really incredible experience to sit down after 6 years of trying and then being able to write this poem in 2 hours. Just called Sandra Lee Scheuer, killed at Kent State University, the 4th of May, 1970, by the Ohio National Guard. You might have met her on a Saturday night, cutting precise circles clockwise at the Moonglow roller rink, or walking with quick step between the campus and a green 2-story house, where the room was always tidy, the bed made, the books in confraternity on the shelves. She did not throw stones, major in philosophy, or set fire to buildings, though acquaintances say she hated war, had heard of Cambodia. In truth, She wore a modicum of makeup, a brassiere, and could no doubt more easily have married a guardsman than cursed or put a flower in his rifle barrel. While the armories burned, she studied, bent low over notes, speech therapy books, pages open at sections on impairment, physiology. And while they milled and shouted on the commons, she helped a boy named Billy with his lisp, saying, "Hiss, Billy, like a snake. That's it. Sss, tongue well up and back behind your teeth. Now buzz, Billy, like a bee. Feel the air vibrating in my windpipe as I breathe." As she walked in sunlight through the parking lot at noon, feeling the world a passing lovely place, a young guardsman who had his sights on her was going down on one knee as if he might propose. His declaration, unmistakable, articulate, flowered within her, passed through her neck, severed her trachea, taking her breath away. Now who will burn the midnight oil for Billy, ensure the perilous freedom of his speech? And who will see her skating at the Moonglow roller rink, the 8 small wooden wheels making their countless revolutions on the floor? Now, that one of the things that surprised me most about that when it was written was that it was not a poem written out of anger anymore. Enough time had gone by that I was able to get outside my own ego and empathize with a specific victim, thanks to I.F. Stone and his details about Sandra Lee.
Mm-hmm.
And it became, instead of a diatribe against U.S. foreign policy, it became a simple elegy. In mm-hmm. fact, an elegy for two people, the victim and the young soldier who had mm-hmm. to live a lifetime knowing that he'd done this, basically.
Which is kind of what Solzhenitsyn said about one day in the life of Ivan Dzhanovich. It's the guards being as much prisoner of the system as the gulag,
right,
people in the gulag. And, yeah, the other thing about that is that the way, because of her being a speech therapist, it's a lot of that is about giving and taking a voice, and the poet giving the voice back, it seems. So.
Yeah, Joseph Conrad is one of my favorite authors. I did a doctoral thesis on Conrad and love his work. And he used to speak about writing as rescue work, rescuing vanishing fragments from and giving them the permanence from memory and mm-hmm. giving them the permanence of art. And so for me, a lot of the writing is rescue work, that trying to reinvigorate a moment in history that ought not to be forgotten, and mm-hmm. giving that back to people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you're part historian.
Yeah, I think poetry is a major vehicle for history. It's so economical as well and spare that it's probably a blind man's kind of vision, and it means that you just have to zero in very, very carefully on specifics and not worry about the whole picture, but somehow make the specifics speak to something universal.
Mm-hmm. I'm just curious here whether or not you have experienced any censorship at any level, because today, the way it often happens, somebody that says something that the government doesn't want to hear will sometimes feel some kind of a reaction to it some way or other.
You know, I went to Chile in the towards the end of the Pinochet dictatorship, doing human rights interviews. I went with Lorna Crozier, Patrick Lane, and Mary DeMichele, and we did interviews with the families of the disappeared. When we were there, we went to talk to various people, and they shared their stories with us. One of these interviews was with Jaime Halas, the editor of a journal called Analysis. And his foreign affairs editor had just been murdered a few weeks before that by Pinochet's thugs. And I asked Jaime about the censorship in Chile, and he laughed. He said, "Here, it's quite unusual here. Your books may survive, but you may not." So when I got home, I began to think about Canada and the relationship mm-hmm. of writers. And I recalled this line by Margaret Atwood when she said, "You can say anything you want as a writer in Canada because nobody's listening." Well, Robertson Davies had something similar. He said, "Being a writer in Canada is about as important or as innocuous as being a manufacturer of yogurt." Now, this was a long time before yogurt became had a new life and right, popularity.
Right.
But for me, I have been lucky in some ways that the only thing that has been censored has been one of the anthologies that I edited. I guess some fundamentalists did not like the way poets used the language and complained about it. But it also has the downside. If you're writing things with a political edge, often people are uncomfortable and will ignore it or deliberately ignore it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Something I was, you know, just listening to the discussion has just been wonderful, Gary. And prior to the program today, I was thinking about the discussion around the writer as witness. And I was thinking about it in the context of when you wrote Kent State and the poem about what happened there. And then more recently now, listening to your explanation of when you wrote that later, relying on I.F. Stone's writing. But then I've listened to you talk about Chile. So I'm wondering the extent to which your poetry has been when you've actually witnessed events as compared to when you've relied on other people's record, like, for example, the one in Kent State.
Yes, that's an interesting issue. What does it mean to bear witness, and what is a witness? It's something that I'm hoping to clarify in my own mind at some point. Much of the witnessing that I've done is, you would call it secondhand witnessing. For example, I went to Africa and did some human rights interviews, trauma victims, and put them together in a book called Drink the Bitter Root, A Search for Justice and Healing in Africa. I started out at the International Criminal Court interviewing people, and the one person that was most useful to me was a young guide in the court. And I said to him, he was a Frenchman from Paris, and I said, what's the most important thing that's ever happened to you at the ICC? He said it was meeting the great French writer Simone Weil. He said she knew a lot about the Holocaust. She was a Jew. She had experienced a lot of these things. She'd been to the Nuremberg trials. He said the things that she said to me was that she had no faith in international justice, but because the ICC had a victims' reparation program, she was willing to put her support behind it. She had this powerful concern for victims of violence of one sort and another. So I went off to sub-Saharan Africa, and I interviewed women who'd been raped and infected with HIV in Rwanda, and victims in Uganda, all the way to Ethiopia, Congo, and Somaliland. All the sweet tourist spots. And in northern Uganda, I met a woman named Nancy who had had her ears, nose, and lips cut off by the Lord's Resistance Army, Joseph Kony's band of murderers. And as she told me the story, I could feel the rage building up in me, and I wanted something to happen to Joseph Kony. I was thinking, a bullet is too good for you. You need to suffer slowly.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Nancy what she thought about this. And she said to me without batting an eyelash, they should all be restored to the community. They were mostly abducted boys. Mm. And I thought, you know, here's the victim counseling forgiveness and restoration, and here's the secondhand listener
mm-hmm.
counseling retribution and so on. So I learned a huge amount during that trip. I had so many preconceptions challenged by meeting these graceful and survivors who were so full of integrity. And so I had this sense of myself as a secondhand witness, and I guess when I got home, I had even more of a sense of that, because I realized, having absorbed all of these incredibly painful stories, I was suffering from a kind of secondhand PTSD.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time to figure out how to write about that material. The thing that really worked was recalling in intimate detail, as much as I could remember, what was happening with the body language and whatnot of Nancy as we talked, and remembering my own state. She looked at me after a while and she changed the subject. She could see what a mess I was in emotionally. And she said, "Gary, your name is like the Acholi word for bicycle." And I said, "Nancy, thank you for telling me that. I'm so glad to be mistaken for an Acholi bicycle, because my my name in Japanese language is the word for diarrhea." And it was that moment when both the laughter and the pain came together that showed me how that book had to be written.
Well, it's really good to have you here, Gary. We've just about got to the bottom of our first half hour, and we're going to be back after our break, and we're looking around for some music to play, and I've decided I wanted to hear Pete Seeger playing a Bob Dylan tune. It's been a while since we've heard from Pete. Of course, he's been gone for a little while now, but I'm sure we'll be hearing his stuff for quite some time. So we'll be right back with Gary Geddes and Bruce Rice. Gordon and I will continue the conversation after the break and after we hear from Pete Seeger.
May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. And may you stay forever young. May you stay forever young. May you grow up to be righteous. May you grow up to be true. May you always know the truth and see the lights surrounding you. May you always be courageous. Stand upright and be strong. And may you stay forever young. May you stay forever young. May your hands always be busy. May your feet always be swift. May you have a strong foundation when the winds of changes shift. May your heart always be joyful. May your song always be sung. And may you stay forever young. May you stay forever young. May you stay. Forever young. May you stay forever young. May God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung, and may you stay forever young. May you stay forever young. May you stay forever young.
And there's Pete Seeger. I'm sure we're all still missing him.
He's, what a beautiful song. Mm-hmm. What a life, too.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Anyway, here we are. We're back with Gary Geddes and Bruce Rice with Gord Barnes and myself, Jim Hutchings, and we're talking about the sort of things that have inspired Gary to write quite a lot of poetry that people have enjoyed and I think found inspirational and educational and all those good things.
You know, when we were talking a little while ago about what happened in Africa and what I learned there, one of the things that guided me in writing about these human rights abuses was a line by Jean-Paul Sartre, who said, no matter how terrible and painful the material you're writing about, it, you have to present it with an essential lightness. Mm-hmm. And finding out a way to achieve that kind of lightness so it doesn't feel as mm-hmm. if you're exploiting the violence and somehow living off of other people's pain mm-hmm. was the challenge. And it's a continuous challenge for me as a writer. And knowing how you stand politically in relation to what you're writing about. In other words, are you in a position of power or can you somehow surrender that power and enter into the politics, the real politics of the situation?
Yeah. Well, there's a Jewish Nobel laureate, I'm sorry, I forget his name, but he said, he wrote a lot about the Holocaust and that type of thing, and he said the purpose of writing was not to cause pain, but to understand it. Yeah. So it's sort of the same. And then so many of your poems are in the voice of people speaking that I have to, you know, you're partly speaking for people who are either unable to speak or even their story is large enough that it has to be something larger. You know, it has to get out in the world too. So in some respects, it's a question of whether you're, what your motives are, but often when you're speaking with victims, they're telling you those stories, so their lives can be validated.
That was certainly the case in Chile. The people I interviewed in the Vicaría were there under great threat to themselves. The Chilean administration and soldiers could put them in jail. These were women who'd lost husbands and children and so on, already young people. And so for them to share their stories with me was considerable, it was courageous, to put it simply. And so I felt this huge responsibility, as you say, to share those stories and find a way to tell them. I'll read you one little piece that came out of that Chilean experience. It's not in poetic form, it's in a sort of prose poem form. It's called Human Rights Commission. The small woman seated before you describes her encounters with the military. In advance of the translation, you hear the phrase, caravan of death. She's not talking about a circus. Her husband has not run away to a circus, though there was one in town the day you arrived, the real McCoy. Medieval etchings of the dance of death flicker in a dark recess of your brain. Do you really want to hear this? Yesterday you were curious, took notes copiously, numbers, implements of torture, the general who traveled the provinces with his exterminators, and a chihuahua that sat on the back of the car seat licking his ear. October 23, 1973, the end of so much. 5 months later, she too is arrested, kept naked 20 days, a sack over her head. Kicks, blows, electricity, threats against the children, pretense her husband is still alive. You look again at this woman and wonder how much she is not telling you. A heated pipe, rats driven into the vagina through a heated pipe. When the interview began, the portable radio was playing Moon Shadow by Cat Stevens. A poster on the wall said, in Spanish, "No one disappears into thin air."
Wow.
That was a difficult poem to write and a difficult poem to read because it doesn't have that essential lightness, and there's not any kind of poetic figurative language in it, very little figurative language in it to detract from the actual stories that I was hearing. But it's a challenge knowing how to do that, and it's a great privilege when it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you wonder how a journalist would be able to convey the same kind of understanding and emotion of the actual situation there. I think that would be an impossible task for somebody just writing prose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, journalism, I have great admiration for good journalists, but of course something about journalism means that much of it is pitched for oblivion, and most of these journalists are frustrated poets and novelists who mm-hmm. would like to be working in a more creative medium. But some of them, since Jimmy Breslin days, have managed to write both the personal and the political into their articles. It's a challenge.
Mm-hmm. But it seems that if you manage to create a poem, it does stand a better chance of surviving than, like you say, the stuff, the Monday morning newspaper that you're going to throw away.
Well, I hope so. I'm sure a lot of my poems and a lot of the poems of my friends are pitched for oblivion too.
No.
we all hope not, but we all suspect in our bones that a good chunk of them will vanish with us.
I suppose that to a large extent, though, really, you're writing this for yourself.
Well, that's true. I feel when I learn about these things happening in Africa and Chile and in related areas in the Middle East, I feel diminished by what's happening to people, and I feel a responsibility. It's like an albatross on my back that mm-hmm. I have to write about to try to make some sense out of it. Mm-hmm. And so that's, I guess for me, it's very therapeutic. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it is for other people as well, hearing the stories, if they're done well.
A commentator whose name escapes me, but he was usually writing pieces on various topics, and he was asked what he thought about a certain thing, and he replied that he didn't know, he hadn't written about it yet.
Yeah, that's great. Well, the way I heard it, I don't know what I mean until I see what I say.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you have to get the gray matter working reflecting.
One of your poems, I think it's the last canto, you've got this line. It says, "I have found poems to be wiser and more honest than the poets." I wonder if you could explain yourself on that, because it seems to be related to what we're just talking about.
Well, there's another epigraph by another writer in the beginning of one of the sections in the book where he says, thankfully, it's still more difficult to tell lies in art than it is in life. Now, there's something about the language, at least in my encounter with the language, that forces me to think and ponder and weigh words and to... It has a kind of built-in critic. And it's a wonderful thing about the language and about the artistic process, that it forces you to... You know, somebody said a politician is someone who comes to every new question with an open mouth. And if a poet does that, it just produces junk. But if you come with a mouth that is weighing and testing every word that goes on the page, then there's a chance that there'll be something enduring happen there.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as the audience goes, when you do research in health research, they discovered very early on that they could ask people questions over the telephone and get answers that were every bit as accurate as if you went to the door and you sat down with the person for an hour. And there's just something about the nature of a voice that, as humans, we understand, and what is poetry but people talking. So I think when there's a false note, that's instantly, you pick that up instantly, and that's what poetry is, and that's why people respond to it. And if there's a false note in that voice, then either it's the poem works, or people hear that false note and you lose them, they're gone.
It's a good point, Bruce. I think of poetry as our first language that we learn as an infant. We hear these rhymed words are so interesting to us, and we're listening before we understand language. We're hearing all of these things, and when we begin to grasp language, we're more interested in the sound than in the sense of things, and we are happy to hear of cows jumping over the moon and dishes running off for a clandestine weekend in Saskatoon with a spoon. And it's only a little bit later that things shift. So we're building what I think of when we're weaned from our mother. We're building the language is a substitute umbilical cord back to the mother and back to all those other creatures that look a bit like her. And it's that language, that intense primary language that we go back to in moments of deep pain and suffering. When we're suffering, we don't go out and look for an essay, and we don't read a novel. But we are likely to go looking for a poem because mm-hmm. of the economy and the resonances that are there, and this, how sense and sound build together to create something. And so for me, it flies under the radar and nests in the ear and gets into the mm-hmm. bone marrow in some sort of wonderful way.
Yeah, after 9/11, I wrote a little piece that went into Freelance here, the Saskatchewan Writers Guild newsletter, and in there somewhere, what I noticed was in moments of, fear or disaster, terrible human events, that people go back to poetry, and it seems like one of the jobs is to prepare people so they have the words when they're needed. And it says something, it is interesting that people have, even if they don't consider themselves, literary or whatever, that they have these words or phrases or poems that they've remembered, and at those times, that's where they go back to.
Yeah, it's interesting the link between poetry and politics. A lot of writers in this country, and in particular in the U.S., think of poetry and politics as strange bedfellows. They shouldn't be together. So there's a kind of relativity in U.S. poetry and in a lot of early Canadian poetry. And I think my work was dismissed a lot because of the political content to it. And they often quote W.H. Auden's elegy on the death of Yeats, where he says, the line is, poetry makes nothing happen. And that's always amused me, because if you read Auden's writing, his essays, he says, the mere making of a work of art is a political act because it reminds the management, etc., etc. And for me, I think I like... There's an American poet, James Scully, who said that the phrase political poetry is not a contradiction in terms, it's an instructive redundancy. Because as soon as we open our mouth, we're revealing our ideology in one way or another. Mm-hmm. And as Robert Haas, the former U.S. poet laureate, said, poetry has the power, the rhythm of poetry has the power to move us and get into our bodies and make mm-hmm. us move. And he said, a power is political. So the very rhythms that we have access to and can construct and so on are a means of reaching people at a deep level.
Gary, I just was thinking during the conversation when you were talking about Uganda and Rwanda and your writing, Have you shared the writing with the people where you've shared their stories? So you've heard the stories of people in Rwanda and Uganda and then written a poem. Have you ever sent it to them and said, you know, this is what I've done?
I've sent my nonfiction book to Africa to several people. And the Chilean poems in a book called No Easy Exit were distributed around Chile by people there because they were translated into Spanish as well. Mm. And the Chilean, I don't know whether this had anything to do with it, but eventually the new Chilean government gave me the Gabriela Mistral Prize for that. So right. That was a case. And people have asked me if the family of Sandra Lee Scheuer has ever seen the Kent State poem. I've never sent it to them. I felt it was an inadequate thing to say to parents after such a loss, even though it's a good poem. It was inadequate. But I'm sure they've seen it because it's in the Kent State Library now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
I was just thinking my years as a student in public and high school, that sort of thing, how many times we were required to memorize poetry. And I see it as a much more important activity now than I did then. And I wish that I had been better at it. But would you agree that this is probably, in the long run, a useful and valuable activity because it puts kind of, well, and Bruce was kind of touching it on in here, it kind of puts building blocks in their heads, and you've got words and phrases and ways of expressing oneself. And if you read a lot of poetry, I think you end up, I guess I'm kind of asking the question, would we get more poets if we had more people paying attention to poetry?
I think you're right, Jim. I think we would. And I remember when I wrote a book of poems about the fall of Hong Kong with the Canadian soldiers who were there incarcerated in POW camps by the Japanese, there was one character who turned out to be the lieutenant governor of Saskatchewan when he came back. He was a YMCA officer in the Winnipeg Grenadiers at the time. And so he was in the prisoner of war camp. He became the librarian. And there were only 12 books. And so the soldiers read them over and over again and wrote interlinear glosses and saying, you know, bullshit, this is not the way it is, or yes, right on, this kind of thing. And the line that I came up with to express his perception was, they read these books so often, eventually they noticed the words. And that's what happens, I think. We read a lot of stuff transparently for plot and character in novels and so on, but poetry forces us to think about words, not just concepts or characters or events. And so that's, you know, and I also put that down to a different kind of challenge we have now with all the technology we have. I mean, even when Xeroxing came along, when I was a graduate student, did a degree in England after my BA here, I wrote every quotation I ever loved in a book, I wrote out. Mm-hmm. And somehow when I came to love them so much that I remembered them all, and I could quote them in reams in exam papers, and to my poor friends had to hear them all the time. Nowadays, with a photocopying machine and all this stuff, we don't do that. You know, 100 years ago, if you had said to your professor, I want to write plays, will you tell me how to write plays? He'd have said, sit down and copy out the entire works of Shakespeare. And if you don't know how to write a play by the end of that, give up.
And yet, you know, with one of the things I like about the spoken word community is it gives a voice to, there's a lot of marginal groups that have been marginalized one way or another that are part of that community. And people are used to the idea of the slam, there's a competition, you got 3 minutes, sit down. But when you hear somebody who's a serious spoken word artist, they need half an hour or more to really do their thing, but that idea that you would memorize something and stand up in front of an audience and recite it is certainly coming back. And even now, I think there's some older poets which are not what's out of the usual spoken word generation are saying, oh yes, you see them memorizing it too. Just not too long ago, there were, I've seen various poets starting to finally memorize their work again. And the great thing about that is that it requires a commitment to the poem, a total commitment to the poem, to recite especially a long piece from memory. And but for the audience, when you're listening to music, you don't think of, oh, I don't know how to read music, how can I understand that? But somehow with poetry, we've had a drum tune to our heads, oh, I don't know anything about literature, so how can I understand this poem? But of course, there's nothing like a live, hearing a poet live or seeing a thing perform. And I think in those moments, those questions don't arrive. It's you and that person and the story that unfolds like it has for 10,000 years.
Well, believe it or not, folks, we've come to the end of our time. And I'd really like to thank Gary for coming and Bruce and talking about poetry in their lives and how they've been affected by other people's poems and things in the world and reacting to them with your own poetry. It has been fascinating, and I hope you have a lot of good fortune with your book tour, you and your wife, Gary. It's wonderful to see you and talk to you like this.
Thanks very much, Jim. It's been a real honor to be here.
And on behalf of Gord Barnes and myself, we only have time to say that Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said, "It's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness."